was reminded when Joshua was talking about that those soldiers marching down the street. I was in Romania about 3 weeks after the revolution, you know, and everything was chaos and confusion, and nobody knew who was in control. And so we passed through.
Cut the mic on.
Yeah, we passed through checkpoints and borders, and we just showed them the American passport. And man, they didn't even stamp it or nothing. They just go, man, go, come, you know. And we thought, boy, this is wonderful. This really opened doors. But anyway, we were over there passing out tracts on the street in Romania in the city of Oradea. And so here comes this long line of soldiers, like you were talking about, and the sergeant or whoever was, help, two, three, and all this business, you know. And so I thought, man, we can't pass this up. I mean, here's these guys, they're all in a line. I mean, you know. And so, man, I headed out there toward those soldiers, and Rick said, Willie, what are you doing? What are you doing? Get back over here. I said, man, I'll give these people the gospel. And so I went out there to the first guy came up, and man, the sergeant said, halt, or whatever he said in Romanian. I guess we all called, they all stopped. And then he said something else, and they all stuck out their hand. So, man, I just went down the line and gave each one of them a track. Then he said something, and all this is in unison. Then he said something else, and they all put their gun back on their shoulder and marched off. Man, you know, you never know what God will do until you get a little crazy, you know, and it's really some good things. You've seen a few things, but you're going to see better things, brother. It's a trip. I mean, if you like things different all the time and exciting, and man, just find somewhere where God's working, you're really going to see a lot things you never dreamed would happen. Proverbs chapter 29. Now, I want you to look at a verse here, and I know you've heard it and read it many, many times, but I want you to look at it, and then I want to ask you a question. Proverbs chapter 29 and verse 18. Where there is no vision, the people perish. Just the first part. Now, someone tell me, just in your own words, give me a definition of that. What do you think that means? Anyone? Right. Someone else. A goal to look toward. What else?
No dreams. Guidelines and laws.
Yeah. Well, I saw something different here. And it never ceases to amaze me. There's nothing like the Word of God. I mean, there's nothing like, you can't read anything like the Bible, where you just keep going back time after time after time and keep seeing things in a little different light each time, and seeing things that you never saw before. But many, many years ago, I I sort of have an analytical mind, and I try to analyze. Now, what does this really say? And I was looking at this, and it does not say when there is no vision, the people perish. But it says where there is no vision, the people perish. So he's talking about a place, not a time. Where there is no vision, the people perish. That could be right here. In whatever place someone does not have a vision, people perish. If a pastor has no vision, his people will die. I mean, spiritually, they'll just be what we call deadheads. They have no vision. They're just content to come and sit on Sunday morning and drop their dollar in the plate and, go through whatever little motions they go through. Most folks could just, really, they could just stay home if you'd send them the bulletin, because they'd know everything that's going to happen anyway. Nothing's going to happen different than what the bulletin states. You know, that would be unlawful. But, you know, if a pastor doesn't have a vision where he and these people that God has given him, he doesn't have a vision where they are going, what direction they're going to take, then things are just going to die. If a church has no vision for their own community, then that community will die without God. If a missionary has no vision, his field, I don't know what percentage, but I know it's huge. The great majority of missionaries have no vision any further than getting maybe 10 or 15 people together in a little building somewhere. And so they'll have somebody to preach to on Sunday morning and stay there for 3 or 4 years. And a lot of times, especially, I don't know how it is in Mexico now, but it used to be a lot of times in Mexico and Central America, the only person they had to leave with the work, a lot of times, just be some 15, 16 year old kid. They want to go back for a furlough. And when they get back, I mean, this kid has no idea how to handle the problems and the various things that come up, and so it's down to nothing. And here he goes, back to square one, start all over again. And it goes on and on and on. I remember, I was just thinking of a trip that Brother Milton took several years ago throughout Europe when things began to open up and communism began to collapse in a lot of places, and where things and societies and governments and different things were changing. You know, the most receptive people are is when they're faced with change. The reason a lot of people get saved in Mexico City and in Lima, Peru, and a lot of these people who come in out of these jungles, leave their jungle culture, leave their families, the peer pressure is not there. They're there, and there's a lot of change. And when there's a lot of change, there's openness. And people will listen. And if a missionary doesn't have a vision of this, then he'll be content just to, you know, piddle along, you know, one step at a time and never really reach his potential. When I went to Romania, I was 60 years of age, and I got over there, and that I thought, well, Romania, this language came from Latin. I can speak a little bit of Spanish, and maybe that will help me, and I'll get along. And I found a lot of Spanish words in the Romanian language. Well, that's okay till they start throwing in these Slavic words in the midst of it. And then everything goes into confusion. And I thought, well, you know, at my age, am I really going to learn this language, or am I just kidding myself? And so I got me a translator. And I really began to think seriously, what can I do? I mean, what is realistic? I'm not talking about some pie in the sky, but what is realistic? And I thought, if I could multiply myself in other men and train them, they've got no language problem, they got no culture problem. And if I could do that, it'd be far more than I could ever accomplish. But when I left in 1997, the end of 97, when I had the heart problems and all there, these men were working in villages and visiting and preaching and starting churches, and most of them were just meeting in home. They didn't have any buildings. You couldn't, all kinds of governmental laws and all that sort of stuff, you know. So they're just meeting in people's homes. But they were starting somewhere between 5 and 7 churches a month. And maybe they had 10 or 15 people. Maybe they had 35 or 40 people in some of these houses. And I looked back on it and I thought, there's no way in this world that I could have done that as one individual. And then I thought, well, I'd really like to reach out further. And so I decided to start a correspondence school. And I put an ad about 1 inch high, 1 column wide in the newspaper back in the classified section. And all the ad said was free Bible study course in your home right to this box number. And within 3 months' time, we had over 3,000 students in a correspondence school. And I thought when I started, because I'd talked to some other missionaries who had got involved in correspondence schools, I thought, well, I'm going to wind up with a bunch of children, which is fine. You know, we've got these courses for all ages. And after I got everything, I analyzed the students that we had, and 75% of them were over 17 years of age. A couple of families came with Child Evangelism Fellowship. And they began to pass out these cards for enrollments in a Bible study course. You know what? In a year's time, they wound up with 27,000 students in a correspondence school. But you know, it takes work. And I thought, well, what am I going to do? I can't grade all of these lessons. I don't even know this language. You know, I don't even know what they're saying. How am I going to do this? So I said, well, I know some people that need a job. I know some Christians that need a job. Some of them lost their jobs. And so I raised a little money and we hired them to come in and operate the correspondence school. And it's amazing what you can get done for $25 a month. I mean, it's really amazing. And I mean, they came, they worked 6 and 8 hours a day. And you know what? The wonderful thing about it was, I expected them just to do, you know, the grading of the lessons and mail them out and answer, you know. Oh, no, not with them. I mean, they wanted to write a personal letter to everyone. And these students wrote back these person, oh, how's your mother and how's your brother? And all that. I mean, man, this thing was, I mean, it just wasn't a Bible study course. I mean, it was a personal relationship developed with people that they didn't even know. And then letters started coming in, say, you know, my aunt came and I, or my uncle or somebody, and I went to church with them and I trusted Christ and I got saved and I found a good Bible believing church. And, you know, it was amazing. But that's what will happen with a vision. Where there is no vision, the people perish. It's true in each place where there is no vision, the people perish. What does it take to fulfill a vision? God's vision. I mean, the vision of a lost world. What does it take? I think in order to fulfill our vision, we must be involved in our vision personally. Personally. Go ye into all the world is not a general, generic statement. Go ye means you and me. We have to somehow be personally involved in a vision if it's going to be real. We have to be involved in person. Not only that, but in purse, in our finances. We read so many passages of scriptures and we think we know what they mean until we really look at them. Jesus did not say, where your heart is, there will your treasure be also. That's not what he said. Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. What he's saying is this. Wherever you place your treasure, whatever you spend the most on is what you love the most. If you make a large investment in life, you make that investment for something that you count very, very important. People make a large investment in a home. Why? Because they count it important. People make large investments in the education of their children, especially when it comes to college nowadays. Why do they do this? I mean, what does it cost a year to go to some college now? $12,000-$15,000 a year? $16,000? Why do people make those kind of investments? Because they think that is very important for their children, and they love their children, and they're trying to provide something for their future. They count it important. And so they place their treasure there. Well, what does that tell us about the souls of men? What does that tell us about what God puts a priority on compared to what we put a priority on? What does that tell us about our heart compared to God's heart? Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And he that soweth bountifully, as our brother mentioned, shall reap bountifully. He that soweth sparingly shall reap sparingly. So if we're going to fulfill the vision that God has given us, we have to be involved not only in person, but in purse. Not only with our finances, not only with our physical effort, but also we have to be involved in prayer. And I know Brother Milton's been saying a lot about prayer this week. Several years ago, I hadn't heard anybody mention this, but I was reading the verse where Jesus said to his disciples, "Pray ye therefore the Lord of the harvest that he'll send forth laborers into his harvest." And it occurred to me that Jesus was making a prayer request to his disciples. And I thought, you know, when we come to church, and a lot of times I go to a lot of different churches on Wednesday night and different times, and they have prayer requests. Someone says, "Pray for my mom, pray for my dad." You can just about any church that you go into tonight, and you could say, ask for prayer requests. And I mean, there would be 5, 6, 7, sometimes more. Pray for so-and-so who has cancer. Pray for so-and-so who has cancer. Cancer, cancer, cancer. I'd venture to say that probably half a dozen people here know somebody close that has cancer. And it's just, and you hear this, and I remember when I first heard this, it really ran cold chills down my spine. But you know what now? So many people have it. So many people say it, it becomes commonplace. We get hardened to these things. And then I realized, you know, I have never heard someone say in a church, "Remember the Lord's prayer request." I never heard anybody stand up and say, "Would you pray that God will call my son to be a missionary?" I never heard anybody say that. I still haven't heard anybody say that. The Lord has a prayer request. "Pray ye therefore the Lord of the harvest that he will send forth laborers into his harvest." He does have a harvest. He has a vision for that harvest. So we have to be, if we're going to fulfill the vision, we have to be involved in prayer. And I must say this because I think it's important. Well, we must be involved in publishing. I think it's really important. I know that God saves people through preaching, and He honors the Word through preaching. And the printed page is never a substitute for a private or a public pronouncement of the gospel. But God did give us the printed page. And we're here tonight with a printed Bible in our hand because God gave a vision to a man named Gutenberg. And his vision was that the Bible, the scriptures that he would print, would fly to every soul born into the world. That was his vision. And the Lord gave the word. Great was the company that published it. When you look through Acts chapter 14, what Paul and Barnabas went back to Antioch after their first missionary journey, and they fulfilled the work whereunto they were sent. It tells all the things they did. They preached. They confirmed the churches and the believers, and they published the Word of God. I think they wrote out by hand scriptures that they knew from memory. All sorts of these things have been discovered, most of them in the, how do you pronounce it? Papyri or something, but all of these, bits of paper and stuff that they found, and some of them were in dumps, but they were scriptures. Some people just wrote out, scripture verses. Much like what we're doing with tracts. To fulfill our vision, we must be involved publishing. And then I think we're going to see the final fulfillment of our vision when we come to the place that Jesus mentions in Hebrews chapter 2. And I want to leave you with this verse. Hebrews chapter 2, verse 9. But we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he by the grace of God should taste death for every man. For it became him for whom are all things, and by whom are all things, and bringing many sons unto glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings. For both he that sanctifieth and they who are sanctified are all of one, for which cause he is not ashamed to call them brethren, saying, I will declare thy name unto my brethren. In the midst of the church will I sing praise unto thee. And again, I will put my trust in him, and again, behold, I and the children which God hath given me. One day, the marriage supper, when the bride of Christ is complete, Jesus will be able to say to the Father, behold, I and the children whom thou hast given me. I know of no greater sense of achievement and joy than to be able to stand before God one day at the judgment seat of Christ and say, Lord, I'm here, but I didn't come alone. I brought some others with me. And I think that's when our vision will really be fulfilled. Thank you, brethren.